65,498 square miles. We've got a lot to cover, so let's get to it. This is Spanning the State. Here's your host, Kristen Bry.
Hello, hello. Happy Tuesday. Happy tax day. Rhea, did you get your taxes in?
At 10 o'clock last night.
Woo! Just made it.
Barely.
Just barely, yeah. One of the good things about being married and now filing jointly is I have given that task to Mike. It's like, here's my stuff. You figure it out. And so I am not sweating like I used to as far as going through TurboTax, clicking all the buttons and being like, do I need to upgrade? Do I need to, they're telling me that I need to pay $200 to make sure I don't get audited. But apparently, with so many people getting fired from the IRS, no one's getting audited. So you should be safe.
Oh, fingers crossed.
All right. Well, indeed, if you have not been listening, I guess, yesterday or today at all, just a reminder that today is indeed the last show of Spanning the State. I will be joining Steve Scafidi starting tomorrow at 10 a.m. every day. Well, not every day. Monday through Friday, 10 to 12 for a new show called Point Taken. And mostly politics, international, national, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Madison. We'll probably dabble in some other categories and topics because we have a lot of interest, but a lot of politics. And so I am very excited for that. I think it's probably no surprise to anyone who listens to the show that I am, while I do have a lot of interest, certainly love talking about politics, but also feel like most things come back to politics. I'm kind of from that mindset that, as we're seeing now, so many things that we kind of just assume or take for granted actually tie back to the federal government and what it funds and who works with it, and just things that you think are going to be part of your daily life that you forget are actually political. And so I am very much looking forward to that. Not that I am not sad to see this show come to an end. I know I talked a little bit briefly yesterday about my good friend Brian and my gratitude towards him for the last year of getting to do this show together. Obviously very thankful for Rhea and getting to build this show with her. But sometimes this is just how it works, you know, as far as looking at the lineup for what WTMJ is, what it's trying to do, and making some evolving. And so I am grateful to still be here. I'm grateful to be able to do the show with Steve tomorrow. I am hoping that people who like this show trust that we will infuse some of the good things about this show into Point Taken, and will follow us either live 10 to 12 or subscribe to the podcast, because I am very much looking forward to that. But we move on and we have one more show to do. So I thought the last 2 weeks, as we've known these changes were coming, I've been trying to book guests that may not have a place on the next show. And so our first topic is exactly that. While it is political, so I could make the argument to Steve that we should have Maddie Heim join us on the next show, I certainly wanted to get her in on this show. So Maddie Heim is a Report for America Corps member and who covers Wisconsin environmental challenges with a specific focus on the Mississippi River watershed. So she's yesterday published a series on wetlands. What are wetlands? I love that she made a video and she goes, wetlands, you know, are where water and land blend together. And I was like, yeah, well, that is right in the name. And so why is she talking about wetlands? What should we be concerned about? Who wants to drain them? Who wants to protect them? Because they are, it's land that's vital for people and animals and the health of our states. So we're going to learn more about that, what the legal and political ramifications are right now, both at the federal level and the state level, and the economic argument for why we should protect them. So we are going to get to that after this on the last episode of Spanning the State. And stick to the wetlands. They should have added that. TLC really missed one body of water that they could have added to this very 90s song, Rhea. But yes, welcome back to Spanning the State. I am Kristen Bry, and welcome to the last show of Spanning the State. But we are going to make the most out of it before I premiere with Steve tomorrow at 10 a.m. for the new show, Point Taken. But yes, we're talking about wetlands, and exactly what they are what they sound like. They're where The water meets the land. And so Madeline Heim, who is a Report for America core member and covers Wisconsin's environmental challenges with a specific focus on the Mississippi River, yesterday published a series on wetlands in Wisconsin. Both she did a video, she did kind of laid out some of the legal issues that are happening right now. So I wanted to have her come on and kind of explain, because it seems like, Madeline, that this is, we don't necessarily think of the wetlands very much, but maybe you do, but most of us do not, correct?
Yeah, that's definitely correct. I think that, you know, wetlands are kind of this like quiet powerhouse. They're not as flashy as, you know, Lake Michigan or the bluffs of the Driftless area, but they are really important landscapes. So I myself have learned a bunch more about what they do as I've been reporting on this project.
So I guess explain a little bit more about that. What role do they play in our ecosystem and like the value that they provide?
So they have kind of a wide variety of different benefits. The one that I think people see most often is wildlife habitat. I saw someone refer to it as they're kind of this biological supermarket, if you will, for migrating birds. Like they've just got everything that they might possibly need while they're on their journey. They also improve water quality because they kind of hold on to sediment and pollutants that might otherwise go further downstream. They store carbon. And then one of the most important things they do is during flood events, they can kind of hold on to floodwaters. They're like nature's sponges, essentially. So they can hold on to those floodwaters so that they don't go cascading downstream. And then during droughts, they can release that water slowly back into the water table. So both of those things are going to grow more important as we face more extreme weather.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because I feel like that, the Midwest and Wisconsin, I think, is less likely to have some of the severe weather when we see fires and hurricanes. But certainly flooding and droughts feel like the number one thing that we are seeing happening more and more here. And so that seems like an important thing. But so Wisconsin has six famous wetlands. Where are they kind of dispersed throughout the state?
Yeah, so Wisconsin has almost 6 million acres of wetlands all across the state. But as you said, we've got these six world-renowned ones, and they are chosen by an international organization called the Ramsar Convention that looks at wetlands that really protect rare habitats, rare animals, et cetera. So the one that people might be most familiar with is Horicon Marsh in Dodge County. Then we've got the Cookagan Sloughs, which are up by Lake Superior. Chewaukee Prairie, which is down in the far southeast corner of the state, the Door Peninsula wetlands up in Door County, the Lower Wisconsin Riverway, and then the Upper Mississippi River floodplain wetlands all along the border of Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa. So they're really pretty nicely spread out all across the state if you're wanting to find an internationally famous one.
There you go. All right, so we kind of understanding why they're valuable. What is the motivation to drain them, or to, you know, who's behind it? Is it farmers? Is it business people? Or like who's kind of arguing that we should be able to use this land for other purposes?
Yeah, so this is something that I found really interesting while I was doing this reporting is, you know, in the past, you know, especially during the colonial days, people really viewed wetlands as just an obstacle that they had to get through to farm and to develop cities and towns. So wetlands developed this really bad rap. That, you know, they were dirty, they were disease ridden. There's even some lore of like monsters and ghosts, if you think of like Creature from the Black Lagoon, etc. So they have this bad rap, and they are still disappearing today. The Mississippi River Basin, for example, has lost the equivalent of 100,000 football fields of wetlands between 2009 and 2019. So even though we know more about them, it's kind of the same reasons. You know, when you talk to home builders associations, they'll say, look, we have a housing shortage. We need to be able to build in these places. And farmers are saying, we need to be able to grow more crops. And then, you know, in addition to, you know, being purposely drained, there's also things that are out of our control, not in Wisconsin, obviously, but down in coastal Louisiana, you've got sea level rise and land loss that is destroying a lot of their coastal wetlands.
All right. So then why are you writing about this now? What's going on as far as the political or legal atmosphere that you felt like this was a compelling thing to report on currently?
Yeah, so this series is part of my work, in addition to working at the Journal Sentinel on the Mississippi River Basin Ag and Water Desk, which is a network of journalists that report all up and down the river. And we meet every week, and we were noticing that we were all covering the implication of this 2023 Supreme Court ruling called the Sackett decision, which essentially narrowed the definition of which wetlands can be protected by the federal government. And at the same time, we know that the river is flooding more often and more intensely, which, you know, environmental advocates say more wetlands on the landscape could help with. So we're kind of watching these scaled back federal protections at the same time that advocates are saying, you know, we actually need more of these wetlands on the landscape. And so we wanted to tackle kind of looking at the whole river from, you know, Minnesota and Wisconsin down to the Gulf about kind of what the status of wetlands is.
So you said Sackett changes the definition of what can be protected federally. So now it's up to the states to decide how they want to protect the wetlands that are in each state?
Right. Yeah. So what's interesting, Sackett came down during the Biden administration, which some people, you know, criticized for being a little bit wishy-washy with implementing it. But the Trump administration and EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin have really made no secret that they are going to take that narrow view, which will erase some federal protections for wetlands. So like you said, that means it's up to states on how much to regulate development of wetlands, if at all. Wisconsin has fairly strong protections compared to other states, but some states don't have any state rules at all. For example, Iowa and Missouri don't. So, you know, depending on what we see forthcoming from the Trump administration, EPA, it'll be much easier to develop wetlands there, and we'll be looking at kind of a patchwork system of regulations that will differ all across the country.
So if we're talking about up and down the Mississippi River, even if there are strong protections in Wisconsin, would there be ramifications that could go like literally upstream or upriver to us if Missouri or Iowa were to really hinder the wetlands in their states?
Yeah, you know, not so much like impacts that would travel upstream. Certainly, we will see that with downstream states. But okay. One thing I have heard about the Sackett implications is that, you know, even though Wisconsin has these stronger federal rules, it will still mean that some wetlands that were federally protected in Wisconsin will lose those protections. And that means the state will have to put in extra work to kind of keep on top of those. And so there have been some concerns, although I don't think we've really seen enough of it come to light yet that I can say a ton about it. But I think that, you know, having more work to do in absence of the federal government might be something that we start to see here in Wisconsin.
And would that have to go through the legislature, or is it something that the DNR could do on its own?
So the rules that we have are written into law, and we pass them fairly early on. Like I said, we've got stronger ones. But yeah, it's kind of yet to be seen about what these implications might be. You know, it's kind of a case-by-case basis as developers would come forward and say, we want to build in this wetland.
Got it.
You know, what might happen.
So then another piece you wrote in conjunction with this series is the economic benefits. We've kind of already talked about what it does as far as for flooding and for wildlife. But as far as the bottom line, which is what a lot of people care about, what are the economic benefits to saving wetlands?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting, you know, another piece of the reporting was, you know, as we're seeing this appetite for federal regulation of wetlands going away, people are thinking about how to spur more interest in saving them in other ways. And I think the clearest way that a lot of people are identifying is their financial benefits that come from their ability to mitigate floods. So there is a grant program that is relatively new in Wisconsin. It just celebrated its first year and put out its first round of money, but essentially giving communities money to learn more about where wetlands could help with flooding on the landscape and then do some restoration. And that's based on a pilot project in Ashland County. Ashland County had really severe flooding several years ago, and their road infrastructure just kept crumbling, like over and over again. They would have bridges wash out. They would have culverts break. And, you know, eventually they said, is there a better way to control this water instead of just having to repair these roads over and over again? And it's super expensive to do so. So they are taking a look at restoring wetlands higher up in the system to hold onto that water. So hopefully it doesn't kind of gush so much toward the roads when it floods. And so that's the pilot project. And it looks like it will be spread out to some other Wisconsin communities. And I know from talking to sources, it's being shopped around in other states as well, because I think it's, you know, it's of interest that it's a voluntary, it's a grant program. Mm-hmm. So outside of that regulatory landscape, but also, you know, a way to solve problems that everyone's thinking about, which is, you know, we all need to use our roads. We all need to use bridges. You know, how can wetlands help with that?
What was the name of the grant program again?
It's got a name that doesn't really roll off the tongue. It's called the Wisconsin Pre-Disaster Flood Resilience Grant Program.
All right. Well, at least it's descriptive.
Right.
All right. Well, fascinating stuff. And so thank you so much for joining us today, Madeline.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Madeline Heim is a reporter at the Journal Sentinel and also a Report for America Corps member, and she covers environmental challenges specifically on the Mississippi River. So thank you so much for being here, and we will be back with more after this. More Chapel Roan. I wonder if that joke will continue on. I think Steve still doesn't know who Chapel Roan is, but maybe by the first month of the new show, he will finally know who Chapel Roan is. But when we come back, we're going to do our last Giving Tuesday. And this one was kind of literally fell into my lap in person. But first, ABC News and local headlines. Welcome back to Spanning the State. I am Kristen Bry. We're moving things around a little bit, so if you're used to hearing Giving Tuesday at this segment, it's going to be at 2:15 today. So instead, I don't know if this will go anywhere, but I was thrilled to see that there could be bipartisan agreement on something that I am very passionate about. So we have talked many times on this show. I have talked many times in my op-eds at Journal Sentinel about those constitutional amendments that I feel like every election we've had in the last two, maybe even 3 years, there has been a weirdly worded amendment and referendum question on our ballot. So much that we're worded so poorly that I've had lawyers be like, I don't even know what this means. And I have said again and again that I feel like this is dishonest, and like I don't like it's like is it leaves it open to people to think that it is worded that poorly in order to purposefully confuse people. But it sounds like at least there's some Republicans and some Democrats who are like, yeah, maybe we should put an end to this practice. So I read in the Cap Times this morning. So on the Republican side, State Representative Jerry O'Connor says that he's always wondered why the constitutional amendments he's voting on were written in such terrible legalese. And similarly, on the Democratic side, Representative Deb Andraka in Whitefish Bay agreed. She is a former elementary school teacher, and so she knows that if we can, you know, write things at a third grade level, I know like USA Today, there's lots of news organizations that know how to write things for a lower reading level so that anyone who reads it understands what it is. We should be able to do that for on our ballots. So there is a group, O'Connor heading them, of Republican legislators who have introduced a bill to give voters more information about the Wisconsin constitutional amendments they're considering. And then separately, Andraka and a group of Democratic legislators have introduced a similar bill requiring that the amendment descriptions be written in plain English. Now, the question is, who gets to decide what plain English actually looks like? But, you know, changes to the state, the founding document is not really a small thing. And so it takes, as we've talked about before, it takes 2 years or more to amend the Constitution, and then amendments are very hard to undo. And so with this, I would like to see, I mean, this is not, I don't think this would change in the Constitution, is not what they're talking about, but actually having a bill that changes how things get worded on our ballots, or at least provide more information when you go to vote. Because I feel like every time people open, whether it's they're checking their ballot when they go on myvote.wi.gov to see what's on there, but the amount of times every election I get questions of being like, what does this mean? And because a lot of times these amendments have political undertones as far as who, which groups, which political party is in favor of them, then a lot of the information that actually gets released is not from the Wisconsin Elections Commission, right? It's not a completely independent, nonpartisan informational piece. Like a lot of the media outlets and different reporters try to put those pieces out. But as far as an official piece of information that informs you, this is what this means, ultimately you end up getting League of Women Voters or the WMC or all the invested groups telling you the ramifications if you don't vote a certain way, if this passes or doesn't pass. And so you get biased information. I mean, it's still information, but it is from a source that is certainly invested in a certain outcome. And so I would be a big favor of both of these bills. Maybe they can get together. Maybe they can join forces and do some bipartisan legislation as far as both writing any referenda that gets on the ballot that is going to amend our Constitution, written in plain language and supplemented with official independent information as far as what you are voting on and what a yes vote or a no vote would actually mean. So I am, at least they're being discussed, they're being introduced. We'll see. We'll see if this actually goes anywhere. But, you know, it's sometimes you got to highlight the good things. All right. And with that, we will be back more to talk about some of the bad things. We touched on it a little bit yesterday when Natalie Eilbert was here talking about federal funding cuts and the impact it's having on different behavioral health and mental health programs. But the same thing is also happening with crisis services for both sexual and domestic violence victims. And so we're going to be talking to Carmen Petrie on the other side of this, who is the CEO of Sojourner Peace Center, to talk about what the fire alarm has been so far as how they're navigating the limbo that they're in when it comes to HHS employees and federal funding. So stay with us on Spanning the State. Welcome back to Spanning the State. I am Kristen Bry. And as I said, when we were talking to Natalie Eilbert yesterday about ramifications of some of the federal funding being cut and the impacts on mental health programs, the same thing is also happening when it comes to domestic violence survivors. And so advocates are warning that the cuts have left them in limbo. And I also got an email from Sojourner Family Peace Center recently that identified the fact that a third of their funding comes from federal grants. And so as they are trying to brainstorm and find solutions to what happens next, I wanted to invite Carmen Petrie on, who is the chief executive of Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee, which is the largest provider of services to domestic violence victims in the state. And so welcome back to the show, Carmen.
Hi, Kristen. Good to be with you.
Good to have you back. So what communication have you received so far about the changes both in funding but also staffing?
I would say, you know, we continue to be in a chaotic and uncertain environment. We're coming off a loss of about $500,000 last year in funding, which, you know, caused us to reduce our staffing by about 10 positions. And we're in a watch and see position right now. $2.9 million of our budget comes from the federal government, and we're preparing for the worst, hoping for the best. We did lose some funding when the budget amendment was passed this year. So, you know, what this means is we're going to have to reduce services. There's just no way we can operate without federal funding. And I also heard the same is true for many of the smaller organizations who have already laid off staff and reduced their hours.
And so you said already staff, but as far as what services are the first to go when you have to start making decisions like this?
Well, I think you're either looking at, you know, most advocacy, you try to go deep with people because it's a very important time in their life. You can only provide shallow services, so you have to look at providing less services to more people just to keep your head above water. So people are waiting longer on the hotline. They're waiting longer for a restraining order. You know, they're staying in shelter beds longer because there's no housing options available for them.
So I know that I read that that Governor Evers has proposed in his budget $66 million to crime victim services over the next 2 years. Have you been able to talk to many state lawmakers as far as where they feel like, as far as trying to make up some of the gap that could happen if for sure this federal funding gets cut?
I have not talked to many individual legislators. The Attorney General was over at the Peace Center last week. We held a press conference just to highlight the voices of programs in the Milwaukee area. You know, Sojourner is one of 8 programs, and there's already some hurt and harm that's happening. And we're looking at potential cuts to navigate what's already on the horizon. I would say the most important thing is our private donors have said, for my entire career, we need the government to be engaged in solving these large problems. And so this partnership between private and public dollars is really critical for the whole ecosystem and the health of our state and the work that we do with vulnerable people.
Have you been able to talk to, I mean, I know obviously in Milwaukee, it'd be Representative Gwen Moore. Has she been able to talk at all?
Yes.
Has she been helpful?
Gwen has been a great champion on this issue. She has gotten us some federal dollars. We've also spoken to Senator Baldwin's office. Representative Vining was out at the press conference. I've spoken to the Attorney General. And the governor's office also certainly is aware of the crisis. Any legislator listening, I would say this is a very, very critical issue. You know, sexual assault and domestic violence is nonpartisan.
Yeah.
And it should concern us all on every side of the aisle. So we need to make sure our services can be sustained.
Well, especially because this is also, I should mention, this is the 50th anniversary of Sojourner Family Peace Center, is it not?
Yeah, it is our 50th anniversary. I never would have imagined we'd be living in such chaos and uncertainty. I think people really need to understand the vital services that are at risk. You know, people who are sexually assaulted, battered, who need an advocate to walk through all of the options and systems and housing. Critical services for people are at risk.
And so what else would you advocate as far as people either starting to learn more or anything that they can do in this time of limbo and chaos?
I would say, you know, there's always three things, time, money, or talent, time, or money are the things that we look for. So certainly get engaged with nonprofit organizations. Make a donation if you can afford it. All nonprofits right now are living in this uncertainty. Make a donation if you have the means to do that. That's really critically important. Get engaged on the issue. Talk to legislators about this interview, what you're hearing. Call us up at Sojourner so we can educate you. Call your representatives. So use your time and influence to ensure that services can be sustained.
And what's the website if people want to get more information on Sojourner?
It's familypeacecenter.org. You can also call 276-1911, 414, and ask to speak to one of our admin staff or senior directors. And we'd be more than happy to talk to you. People are reaching out. They are making donations. It's really important at this point.
Absolutely.
That happens.
All right, Carmen, thank you so much for making time today.
Thank you, Kristen.
Absolutely.
Good luck with your job change.
Oh, thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay,
yes. Have a great day. Carmen Petrie is the chief executive of Sojourner Family Peace Center in Milwaukee. This is what I was talking about at the top of the show as far as politics touches everything. And services that are completely nonpartisan and don't know a political party and things that you don't know that you're going to need until you need them, including domestic violence services that can affect people who are very wealthy and people who are very poor. They do incredible work over there. So if there is something that you can do or donate, Carmen is a saint walking about amongst us. So with that, we will take a short break and be back after this. There we go. Welcome back. Before we head to the top of the hour news, I wanted to take a personal privilege and just give a big shout out to the surgical staff at Meritor Hospital in Madison. I think it was about a year ago that I had a, I don't know if rant is the right word, but I had a bit of a tirade because I was very upset about some of the health processes when it came to my Uncle Doug. And a year later, he had to go back in the hospital. And last week, things were not looking great. And I was up in Madison at Meritor with my mom over the weekend while he was in the ICU. And now he's turned a corner. So knock on wood, if you are a religious person or a soulful person, any good juju or prayers you can put out there for my Uncle Doug, I'd appreciate it. But I just wanted to say, as far as the staff there, and they saved his life. The surgical staff has saved his life, but even more than that, as the empathy and emotion that they have led with my mom and with my uncle, because that's not always the side that you get with healthcare, especially surgical teams, as far as it being more you're in, you're out, but how much my mom has just raved about the care that they have received there. So I wanted to at least shout that out and give a big thanks to everyone over at Meritor. So with that, when we come back after the top of the hour news, we will spin around the state on Spanning the State.